Welcome to Steamy Climate Talks with your host, Jordana, where conversation evaporates. Today, I'm having a conversation with my colleague and friend, Justin Buldahl, a UBC undergraduate student working under Professor Roland Stahl with the Weather Forecast Research Team. He studies atmospheric science and has a strong interest in the impacts of climate change on economics. Justin, welcome to the Steamy Climate Talks with Jordana. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to share about you the information I've been doing some research on.
Awesome. So can I kick us off with a question here?
Go ahead.
So there's been a lot of talk about changes to the climate globally, but how has climate change affected Canada so far? And what are the projections for future climates in Canada?
Well, indeed, the climate has been changing in Canada. Unfortunately, Canada is a big country and has not as large a population as some other countries, so we don't have observational data for all of Canada for a very long period. But since 1948, there's been a good amount of stations recording climatic data that allow us to estimate that the climate in Canada is warmed by about 1.7 degrees Celsius for the country as a whole between 1948 and 2016. But if we focus on the northern section of Canada, so the northern territories and northern Quebec, we see that the climate has been warming, in fact, by 2.3 degrees Celsius. There's actually a map, maps that have been made to show that the warming in function of the region, and you can indeed see that the warming has been the strongest in the northwest section of Canada, and the smallest warming has been seen in the southeastern portion of Canada, in the Maritimes. The climate has been warming globally, but in fact Canada has been warming twice as fast as the global average, and the northern communities almost three times as fast as the global average. But you also see that the climate has not been warming evenly across region, as I mentioned, but also not evenly across seasons. The winter has been warming faster than any other seasons, with warming of 3.3 degrees Celsius for the country as a whole, warmings of 1.7 degrees for spring and fall, and 1.5 degrees Celsius for the summer. If we look at precipitation, again, there's sparse data, so it's harder to establish a national trend. But if we look at the data that we have since 1948, it's been estimated that the precipitation have increased by as much as 20%, with the strongest increases in the northern communities. But one thing that's important to remember is, since the precipitation in the northern communities is already so low, a relative increase of 20, 30, even 40% is in absolute terms not that large, but it still has large impacts on the climate over there. But if we look a little bit at the projections for Canada and a warming climate, if we use the RCP 4.5, which is a moderate emission scenario, we see that it is forecasted that the climate will warm for Canada by 4.4 degrees Celsius on top of the warming that has already been seen between the pre-industrial cycle and 1971 and 2000. So that's the period of reference, 1971 to 2000, and we see a warming of 4.4 degrees Celsius on top of that, according to an aggregate of models. And we also see an increase in precipitation of 13.3%. So that's for one scenario, the RCP 4.5, which estimates that emissions will peak at mid-century, and there's relatively strict climate policy that are implemented. But there's other warming scenarios that exist, some that are more optimistic, some that are less optimistic. But the RCP 4.5 is a good one to look at.
You've mentioned that Canada's yearly global temperature is projected to increase by 4.4 degrees Celsius relative to 1971 to 2000 average, and that yearly precipitation is projected to increase by 13.3% for the same period. Can you tell me more about how these projected changes vary by season and region in Canada?
Yes, of course. But before I dive into that, I would just like to note that this 4.4 degree Celsius of warming is the median of the RCP 4.5 climate model scenario. And but just for that given scenario of RCP 4.5, so moderate emission scenario, there's a wide range of predictions from all the models. And with all the models, there's a 90% confidence interval that can be made for the warming that will be observed in Canada. And just for that, there's a range that goes between 3.2 and 7.6 degrees Celsius. So we do not only see variability in regions and seasons, but also in the outcome for Canada itself just by looking at different models. But if I get back to the question, indeed, the season will warm at different rates. It will be kind of a continuation of what we've already seen. So the winter warming faster than other seasons, spring and fall in between, and summer warming a little bit slower than the rest. And same thing for precipitation too. An increase in precipitation, mostly in the north, although there's a couple things with precipitation that I will talk about soon in functions of the different regions. So yeah, as I said, a faster rate of warming in the northern territories of Canada, still warming in the south, but not as fast. The different in warming in the season of winter will have the greatest gradient between the north and the south. So the winter will warm up faster everywhere, but the warming will be much faster in the north and slower in the south. But if we looked at the summer, then we see a much more uniform warming across the country, with the south potentially warming even a little bit faster than the northernmost regions of Canada. For precipitation, you see an increase for everywhere in the country for the year as a whole. But if you look at the summer, then you see a very different story, because the regions like southern BC and the prairies are projected to have lower precipitations than what is currently observed in the period, while the north is projected to have very significant increases in their summer precipitation. There's also some other variables that are projected to change a lot, such as the winter minimum temperature in a year. So within a year, there's always the coldest temperature that's recorded. And with the new climate projections, this is a variable that's projected to increase a lot. And it's a very significant one, because the coldest winter temperature in a year, that determines which growing zone you're in, and the growing zone determines which plant species and other invasive species like insects can survive in this area. So with a change in the minimum winter temperature, that can have pretty significant effects on the region. But yeah, that's a big thing. But if we go back to the summer precipitation and the warming temperatures, that's also going to be pretty significant, because with a decrease in precipitation in the west and increased temperatures, that should significantly reduce the water availability, which will also affect agricultural yield. But that's something that we'll talk about more in later portions of the podcast.
Climate changing differently through the seasons and regions in Canada, how is this supposed to affect extreme weather events?
Well, there's the main extreme events that are going to be impacted, such as the main impacts are that there's going to be more extremely hot days, more frequent and increased severity of intense rainfall event, greater risk of wildfire ignition during a longer fire season, and more coastal flooding due to rising sea levels. But if we focus on the extreme heat, the extreme precipitation event, and fire weather, we see that the return period of extreme heat event and extreme precipitation event will decrease a lot. So for example, if there's an event that happens every 50 years under a high emission scenario, extreme precipitation events that have a return period of 50 years are projected to now have a return period of 10 years. So they will become five times more frequent under a high emission scenario. And for, like, let's say, for example, the 20-year return period, the return period now becomes the return period is now 5 years. Another thing that can be observed with this, the warming climate under a high emission scenario is the intensity will be increased. So for an event that had a return period of 20 years in the current climate, by the end of the century, the same event with a return period of 20 years would now be 25% more intense for a high precipitation event. The return period is even more dramatically affected for temperatures, where we see that extreme heat events with return periods of 50 years will now have a return period of only 1 to 2 years. So very rare extreme heat event would become much more frequent in Canada. That is reflected by an increase in the number of 30 degree days in the south, where they're already observed that relatively they're not that frequent, but in a high emission scenario, they will become much more frequent. And the region that experiences 30 degrees now has somewhat of a limit in Canada. It doesn't expand past a certain line of latitude, depending on where in the country. But with a warming climate, you can expect that line to expand northward, and there's a greater region that will experience intense heat. With this increased intense heat and decreased summer precipitation that I talked about for the last topic, we can expect more intense fire weather conditions, and extreme fire weather conditions would become more frequent, which would lead to more dangerous forest fire conditions that can threaten more people in Canada. So that will be something that we'll have to be wary of.
It seems like there's a lot more weather disruption in store in a warming climate. Are there estimates of how costly these natural disasters would be in the future in Canada?
Yes, it's always difficult to accurately estimate how costly natural disasters were, because we don't know exactly where they're going to happen or how intense they're going to be. But you can make some estimates indeed. If we looked at past trends, we see that for extreme weather events, costs have risen by 1,250% since the 1970s, which seems very, very high. But if we adjust for inflation, it's since 1970, we still see that there's been a 73% increase in the cost of extreme weather events in real dollars by 1970. By the same trends, you see that the total amount claimed to insurance companies from natural disasters has doubled every 5 to 10 years since 1980. So that could become a very costly trend if it keeps on going like this. And this increased cost and claims to insurance companies due to natural disasters can be mostly explained by the increasing intensity and frequency of natural disasters, but also the growing population and expansion of the area that is occupied by humans, which produces more assets to be in the way of natural disasters, and also with increased risk and frequency and sometimes zones of areas that can be affected by certain natural disasters, there's an increased exposure to risk. There's been one estimate in the short term that estimates that the cost, the claimed amount in insurance companies due to natural disasters could climb to $5 billion per year by the year 2030, which is more than twice the amount that was the average in 2020, which was about $2.1 billion per year. And that's only the cost of natural disasters that's claimed to insurance companies. There's other costs that are not covered under insurance, but there's also indirect costs due to climate change, such as or natural disasters, such as the loss in productivity. For example, if there's a flooded highway in an area, well, a company that would do delivery, for example, would have lost revenues from that, because they either have to take a longer route, or people in their commute to work are losing time and they're not able to be as productive. But there's also things that cannot or are hardly able to be predicted. If you think of the loss of a natural park, for example, that doesn't have economic value in itself, but there's some economic estimates that can be made with that, with techniques such as revealed preference, but let's not get into that.
that has a value, an economic value that people accord to it, even though there's no quantifiable amount of value that can be attributed to those events. But if you think of the natural park in Jasper, for example, that burned due to wildfires this year, that's a cost of climate change that cannot really be quantified cost estimates. There's a lot of estimates that are being made, but it varies a lot from different scenarios, and they're very hard to predict because you never know where the natural disasters will strike.
Those increasing costs associated with climate change, has there been estimations on how climate change would affect the Canadian economy?
Yes, there's been many estimates. Again, it's hard to estimate those things. And Canada hasn't really done specific studies for Canada as a whole, for the whole impact on the economy recently. But there's been different studies that have looked at both the direct and indirect costs of climate change on the Canadian economy. One of them estimates that the GDP would be decreased by $25 billion per year by 2025 if we compare it to what the GDP would have been if there had been no climate change, which corresponds to approximately $630 per person. But this is a cost that will increase with time because climate change has compounding effects on the economy. And this depression or lowering of the GDP due to climate change is estimated to be a $35 billion reduction of the GDP by 2030, and as much as $80 to $103 billion per year by 2055. So that's a reduction in GDP every year. So there's other estimates that have been made on the cumulative cost of climate change by the end of the century. So that adds up this reduced GDP every year. And they've compared what the cost of climate change would be under a low emission scenario versus a high emission scenario. And they found that a high emission scenario would be about twice as costly as a low emission scenario, where by the end of the century, the cumulative cost each year of climate change would be about $2.7 trillion to the Canadian economy, while there would be $5.5 trillion by the end of the century under a high emission scenario. So that is a lot of money. It's about 1 year of lost GDP under the low emission scenario and almost 2 years of lost GDP for Canada under a high emission scenario.
One of the great questions that always comes up when we talk about climate change is, what should we do about it? And I was wondering if you had a take on this.
Oh, that is a complicated question. There's many different ways that would get us to emission reduction in the future. So it would be, when you look at cost effectiveness, there's different solution that would get us there. So it's very hard to put a cost on what it would take to reach carbon neutrality or reach current emission reduction goals. There's one study that looked at how much it would cost in subsidies and investments for Canada to reach its target emission reductions of a reduction of 40 to 45% by 2030 relative to 2005 levels. And they estimated that it would cost about $200 billion between now and 2030 for Canada to subsidize abatement of emissions. But often you find that in economics, the first unit of emissions are the least costly to abate. And when for the last unit of emissions, it costs more because they're harder to abate. So different solutions or systems that can be put in place to reduce emissions in the long run include a carbon pricing system, which could be either a carbon tax or a cap and trade system. They both have their strengths and weaknesses. They both would correct for market externalities that are caused by pollution, so costs to the society that are not accounted for, and the cost that it is when you sell it. So they would both correct for that externality. They would also, well, by correcting for externalities, it would allow to prevent certain market failures where the market is not at its most efficient outcome, where society is most prosperous. The carbon tax doesn't have a specific limit in the amount of emissions, so it requires a lot of estimation by the government to reach a certain goal, which is always somewhat uncertain, so it's hard to reach a specific reduction in emissions with a carbon tax, but it of course reduces emissions, while the cap and trade will just set a certain limit to the amount of emissions and will then let the free market buy and sell the carbon credits and carbon allowances. So that might be easier to implement to get specific emission reductions. But both policies incentivize the firms and companies to reduce the emissions because there's a direct cost to emitting now, or there's an upside to not emitting under the cap and trade system. So that would both incentivize companies to invest in new technologies that would allow to reduce carbon emissions at a lower cost. But if you think of subsidizing new technologies in clean industry, that might be done more easily with a carbon tax because there's the direct revenues to the government that are being brought by the carbon tax, and that will allow to make the development of certain green industry and new technologies easier. So to achieve this this transition in the climate, it's very important to account for the negative externalities of pollution with carbon pricing systems, which will allow us to reach market equilibrium and have the most prosperous future with the right amount of climate change.
This was very informative. Thank you so much for your time today. I know I definitely learned something, and I'm sure our viewers did too.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, this was Steamy Talks with your host, Jordana McEachran, and our special guest, Justin Buldahl. Stay tuned for the steamiest climate stories and join us next week.